I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back. Today, I have a guest that will talk about a topic that is so timely. I don't know if she knew it was going to be that timely when she was writing her book, but I basically connected with today's guest, Rachel Scofield, on LinkedIn. You basically connect. I'm impressed with her work. She's impressed with my work. And then she said, Penguin must have sent you a copy of your book. Of course they didn't, because I didn't have an address for such a long time. Anyway, so they might have sent it to some address that didn't arrive to me. So I said, what was the book about? And it is The Guide to Career Change. What a timely topic. And there is probably nobody better able to talk about it than Rachel, because Rachel had a very serious career change in her life. She started her career in the BBC as a reporter and a presenter, did that for quite a bit of time, very successfully, I may say. And then suddenly, at a point in her life, like most of us do, said, that's it, done. I am going to shift to helping others. So she became a coach on career change, you know, basically helping people succeed, focused, passionate specifically about women and women's career and women at the workplace, but of course helping everyone. And then because she's so good at what she was doing, she was recording a podcast a while back, and then a publisher said, you have to write this down. And that's where The Guide to Career Change came to existence. It is not what you expect a book about career change is. I felt looking at it that it was a bit of an introspection book. It was about self-change that would lead to career change. And I think for my audiences here on Slow Mo, that's probably a topic that is very, very highly encouraged. Rachel, I am delighted that we finally meet. I'm so grateful that you reached out on LinkedIn and that we know each other now. So thank you for being here.
It's an absolute pleasure, Mo. Thank you for responding to my LinkedIn messages and starting that conversation.
So Rachel, I have to ask you a question, because a lot of people today are very worried about career change. It's not an easy time. It's a time where you hear of layoffs all the time and big companies laying off 10,000 people here and 15,000 people there. And it seems to me that everyone is like, whatever career I have right now, I'll just hang on to it. I don't really care, right? Are you supportive of that view? Is that the right thing to do?
What a great question to start with, because you're right. I think we've had this convergence of two periods of time. I think we had COVID, which was a massive wake-up call for a lot of people in terms of what their work was all about. I think it sort of divested us of so many elements of our work and pared it back to the real bare bones that many of us thought, oh, this job is not really what I love at all. It was the people that I love and I can't be with them anymore. So do I want to do it? So on the one hand, we've had this massive hand grenade thrown into our lives with COVID, which has led to a lot of people rethinking not just their work life, but their whole life to some extent. And you're right, then hot on the heels and directly connected, of course, is a time of economic downtime and uncertainty, which makes people want to hunker down and go, oh gosh, I'm in this state of tension where I've got part of me saying, enough's enough, don't really love the job, ready for a change, but am I bonkers to even think about it at this point? And I think there's probably no simple answer. Some people will be quite risk averse and will say, you know, my own circumstances are such that this is the moment for me to prioritize, you know, paying my mortgage, having a certain regular income that I need. It's not the time for me to take a risk or to make a change. But that will very much depend. And I think when I work with people, it's often allowing people to engage with the worry, recognize the concerns, and then actually get properly curious about them. We so often get caught up in the assumptions of career change, of I can't change career because I can't, haven't got time to retrain. I'm too old. I've left it too late. I'd have to take a pay cut. All the buts that I talk about, the get off your butt.
That was actually a very interesting start to the book. You know, in the first part of the book, you have all of those buts, you know, real caricatures, really, but all of the buts, why I shouldn't change my career. It's so interesting that you put it that way, because yes, there is a lot of justification and overthinking. And maybe one of them is, yeah, and it's a difficult time economically, I shouldn't be looking at it, right?
Yeah. And the thing to do is not to ignore that thought, is to engage with it, because it is going to be a personal decision. And I would never say, I'm not in the school of, you know, follow your dreams and follow them off a cliff. That means you can't meet your mortgage and you can't sort of look after your elderly mother. But let's have a look about these assumptions you're making, that you'd have to take a pay cut or it's a disastrous time to change job, because it will depend a lot on what you're looking at, on what industry you're in, what sector you work in, what resources you have at your disposal. So I think it's always a question of, let's get curious before we write off anything. Let's really deal with facts and not assumptions about what's possible for us. And for some people, they may conclude, no, this is not the right time. And other people will get creative in their thinking, will do the research that they need, and it will enable them to see that if I approach it in this particular way, or if I take my time, or if I, you know, there are ways that they can do it successfully. So it's very personal.
I think that's a fantastic answer. I always tell people, you know, because of my sales career, that sometimes we negotiate with ourselves before there is even a deal on the table. So we would say, no, I'm not going to do this, it's the wrong time, or no, I'm not going to do this, I'm too old, whatever that is. When in reality, nobody's even telling you that there is something that you can do. Like, so what are you negotiating here? And maybe you should go out and be curious, like you rightly said, and then find out what's possible, and then start negotiating and saying, oh, that is possible, but it requires me to retrain. Maybe I don't want to do that. Or that is possible, but it requires me to move, and maybe I don't want to do that. You seem to be a chronic career changer. Like, I mean, I have to say this, because the first time we met, you told me that when you went to school, you had two dream jobs, which were what?
Oh, well, I fancied being an actress. I was a linguist, really. I studied modern languages and loved French and German. I went on to do Italian. So part of me thought I'd quite like to use that communication skill as an actress, and I looked into that. But actually, to be fair, I don't know if I even had just two ideas. I had lots of ideas, like most of us do at school. Uh-huh. You sort of flip between one thing and the other, and you choose, what am I going to study next? What shall I study at university? And then you get to the end and think, oh, I've got a French, German and Italian degree. What am I going to do with that? And weirdly, I thought I might apply to the Foreign Office. That was another one of my ideas, to be a diplomat, you know, go and live in Paris and help Britain with its place in the world, whatever it was. But it took a turn, Mo, because I applied for the British Foreign Office, which is the diplomatic service, all very above board, a lot of stuff about trade and culture. I thought, that's right up my street. Didn't get in. You have to sit a horrendously difficult exam. I was told by letter back then, no emails, sorry, you weren't successful. And I thought, oh, that's a shame. And then about 2 weeks later, I had a letter arrive to me at university saying, we noticed you recently applied for the Foreign Office and were unsuccessful. Occasionally, other opportunities arise in the Foreign Office, and we wondered if you might be interested. And long story short, the other opportunities, which sounded very secretive, were indeed very secretive, because it was an approach from MI6, which is the British Foreign Secret Service. We have MI5, which deals with kind of homeland security, and we have MI6, which deals with overseas threats to the UK, terrorism, drugs, all the kind of bad guy stuff. Uh-huh. And yeah, and I went part way down that process. I think I'm allowed to talk about this now without, you know, being disappeared. And then decided it wasn't quite for me, because I think I wasn't comfortable with all the secrecy, the fact that probably, you know, you end up living a life where you can't ever really tell anybody what you do. You have to have a whole front. But it was a fascinating experience. So yeah, my life could have been very different. I might not have ended up at the BBC. I could have been, you know, cloak and dagger out there in the field doing something a little bit more hairy.
Spy work, yeah. I mean, we have to admit, both you and I, that the best way to hide that you're a spy is to say, oh, I failed 17 or whatever, 20 years ago, and I never got into MI6, wink, wink, when I know for a fact you would actually make a very good 007. I can see it. I can see you in the Aston Martin. It's very, very clear. And that's not a bad career.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe I could have been the female James Bond. But yeah, and you're right. I do sometimes joke with people and say, you know, I didn't get in. Or did I?
Am
I just not exactly telling you? Because if I told you, I'd have to kill you, Mo, and then where would we be with the podcast? So.
Exactly. I mean, I think the problem is you don't know what my actual career is. You know, 1 billion happy is a very good facade for. Anyway, let's not scare anyone. You guys listening, you will be spared. Let's just put it this way. So I want to say, and then you went to the BBC, which is not the easiest place to be, and it is very different than being in the Foreign Office. And with all due respect, it doesn't use a lot of French and German. Where did that come from?
I blame my husband for that, Mo, because part of the reason I thought I would join the BBC was because I thought I would use my languages. I had a vision of going, you know, being Rome correspondent for the BBC. What a glorious job that would be, reporting on the Vatican and sort of
and
crazy
pizza.
Berlusconi politics as it was then, and eating pizza and, you know, meandering by the Trevi Fountain. And I thought how glorious that would be. And I had a dream of doing that when I started out as a journalist, and then made the mistake of meeting my husband, who is also a journalist, but very much based in the UK. In fact, I think the first conversation I had with him at an event was to say, how do you become a foreign correspondent? Because he worked for the BBC and he'd worked as the South Africa correspondent. So I thought, great, this is a guy I need to talk to. This is a networking opportunity. Unfortunately, it didn't turn into a job. It turned into a relationship and a marriage. And I never went to Rome, Mo, but...
Yeah, but it is a job. A relationship and a marriage is quite a bit of a job, I have to admit. It doesn't have the finesse of the ice cream in near the Vatican, but that's quite interesting. And this was a very, very, very solid career. Like, you did this for a while, right?
Yeah, I spent 20 years at the BBC, and I did what a lot of journalists do, is you work your way up. You start in local radio and local TV. So I started in the northeast of England on BBC Radio Newcastle, and moved on to the television news there, and then gradually moved to London and did some work on the radio stations there, and ended up after a while being a news presenter and spent a long time on the BBC's 24-hour rolling news. And yeah, there was something wonderful about that. I mean, for whatever people think about the BBC now, and there's a lot of debate in the UK about public-funded broadcasting, which we won't go into, but for me, the BBC had a very valuable role. It was very well respected. I felt very aligned with this idea of we're creating impartial news. We are trying to report things in a way that really informs and empowers people. And it had a wonderful sense of, here's a career that lures lots of us, isn't it? The BBC was a weighty, serious, respected organization. And I loved working for it for 20 years. And I think that was part of the thing that made making a shift when I hit my 40s challenging. And what challenges a lot of us is that we've had an identity through our work. You know, I work for the BBC, certainly said in the UK, people get it, and it has an immediate currency, and it gives you this sense of, I'm a journalist, I'm a serious person, the BBC stands for this and that and the other. And letting go of that and thinking, I'm going to retrain, I'm going to do something totally different, I'm going to start at the beginning as a coach. There were moments where I thought I must be mad. And I think that happens for a lot of people. Career shifts, certainly big ones, play havoc with your identity initially, because you're letting go of something as well as stepping into something.
That's actually really interesting when you think about it, because I often get asked if I miss working at Google. And damn, I miss working at Google, but I don't at all. I really don't at all. I mean, there is a very interesting side of me that says, and I don't know how to say that anymore, but that says this has never been me. I mean, I was really good at it. I was so good at being a corporate executive. I mastered the art of not being political and not creating enemies and not engaging in the game that stresses everyone. And I was really delivering results and made a massive difference. Perhaps the person I was then was that person. But I look at myself now and I can promise you I would never be able to do that. It's so not me. It is so not what I want for my life. And when I was leaving Google X, I made 1.5 million excuses for myself not to leave. It's really quite interesting. Now I'm making 1.5 million excuses for myself to never be back.
Yeah. But how fascinating, yeah, to see and to unpick what goes on in people's minds about feeling where they belong and what is, as you said, it was never really me. And I think, yes, you're right. A lot. I didn't have that with the BBC. I was very happy there. And it was only in sort of...
No, I was very happy too. I mean, when I was there, I was very, very happy. But as you rightly said, I drew my identity as that shrewd, successful businessman. Okay? And look at me, I'm a teddy bear. I'm like, really, I'm not shrewd at all. I'm a really nice businessman, right? And it's quite interesting how I fell into that trap. I remember vividly, Rachel, it was 2008, where I was in a big talk somewhere in front of 10,000 people. And they said, you know, those serious talks where everyone is dressed in striped suits and crossing their hands in front of the camera. And they asked me, so what is your mission in life? And I said, my mission in life is to help startups from outside the Western world build technologies analogous to Google. And the funny bit is I believed it. I believed that this was my mission in life. Right? And I sucked at it. Like, I mean, think about it. It's interesting. I didn't suck at it. That's unfair. But it's not what I stand for at all today. It's just so different. Anyway, back to you. I will say openly, I had the same relationship with the BBC, believe it or not. Because I will tell you, at the time when you were really active in the BBC, I believe that the new BBC was the only impartial news source in the region. For a very long time in the Middle East where I grew up, the BBC was the only, when you wanted to know the truth, don't listen to the local news, go and listen to the BBC. And then I stopped listening to the news. I don't know if you know that about me, but I find the news to be very stressful. So I stopped a long, long time ago. And so I sort of forgot what the BBC stood for. And then there was Top Gear. Huh. And that, and then I realized, man, I love those people. But you were saying that when you approached your 40s, everyone, please watch the YouTube video of this recording, because I actually think Rachel will approach her 40s in around 12 years. But anyway, I'm not giving her a compliment. Like, literally, guys, go and comment on the YouTube video. Either she knows something about lighting that I don't know. But anyway, but Rachel, so you then approaching your 40s, decide to give up on all of this and you decide to become a coach. Take us through that. Basically, I think summarizes your whole book. In your book, you say there are 5 stages to career change. I don't know if preparation applies to that move that you did, but take us quickly through, maybe very quickly, what the 5 stages are. And if you take the example of your own career change, how would those apply?
So you're right. There's a first step, which is around preparing, which I think is probably what I didn't do. And is the step that I've added in with hindsight, because I talk about the fact that it's going to take time and you need to do that work around identifying your constraints, getting off your butt and getting ready to be courageous, be committed to a career change, because it's not going to take 5 minutes. It might take 6 months. It might take 12 months. And you need to be curious. That's another skill. So I spend some time there, but that's probably the bit I missed. But certainly the second step, which is a big one, which is around reflection. And I think this is where I did quite a bit of work for myself, not in this structured way. I've imposed that afterwards, but that idea of building what I call a career profile. I did it in an ad hoc way, but thinking, what is it that I actually want? Because, of course, the temptation is to jump to the question, what other job could I do? Yeah. But actually, before you get anywhere near that, it's much better to ask the question, who the hell am I? And what do I want from life? And that's a big question. So I break it down, and many career coaches will. But in the book, I talk about looking at things like, what am I really good at? And within those things, what do I actually enjoy doing? Because the sweet spot, of course, for any profession is to be involved in activities daily that not only are you good at, but that actually light you up and you find enjoyable. So looking at your strengths, looking at your values. And this, when you were talking about your time at Google, this resonated for me, that idea of how does my work sit alongside who I am? You know, am I shrewd or am I a teddy bear?
That's a question for our listeners to vote on, please. You know, add your answers in the comments. Am I shrewd or am I a teddy bear?
I think hopefully there's more of a range of values than the two. We won't go, but it's interesting. It is almost saying, what is the essence of me and what is my work about? Your work values are around, you know, when I turn up at work, is it for me about status and recognition and money? And there's no shame in that. You know, it's about honesty, isn't it? What do I really want from work? Is it about impact and purpose? Is it about fun and adventure? Is it about collaboration and teamwork? So thinking about what you want from your work, thinking about what success will look like. What does success mean to you? Because some people are carrying all kinds of thoughts around success that they've maybe inherited from parents, from school, from a previous job that they had or an industry they worked in, which might have a very rigid view of this is what you will need to do to be successful. So asking yourself, what do I want to do to be successful? What does success look like for me? So all that kind of reflective work, what interests me, what excites me, is something I'm passionate about going to be important in my work or not? So that reflective space is a big step to work through before you can then start to generate ideas. And step three is all around imagining and designing.
Hold on, let's stick with step two for a while. So upon your reflection, when you're so successful, you like your career, you like your job at the BBC, how does that reflection lead you to change?
I think because I liked bits of it and didn't like other bits. And I think that's what often happens as we evolve and as our jobs evolve. Suddenly what you thought you'd signed up for has turned into something else, or who you thought you were has turned into something else because you've got older, because you've become a parent, because you are looking at retirement and you're going to work for 20 more years instead of 50. You know, there are so many changes that happen that suddenly it's good to reflect and check in regularly. So, I mean, actually, this book, I always think, is not necessarily just for people who think they want to do something radically different. It's almost just saying it's worth doing a kind of stock take, a little career audit every few years, maybe even every year, to say, which bits do I like? What do I want to do more of? What do I want to do less of? Where do I find the energy? Where do I find myself just drained by some of the things I'm doing? And I think for me, then the reflection took me to some core skills that I loved using around communication and questioning. You know, I'm a journalist. I like asking questions. I'm nosy. I'm curious. But what I had noticed was that the subject matter no longer felt meaningful to me. And that might sound weird because obviously there are a lot of news stories that are really, really important. But I think I'd been doing it so long that a lot of the news agenda, and bear in mind, this was the time of Brexit and the discussions in the UK about our relationship with the European Union and so on. For me, it had become so frustrating because I felt like I turned up at work every day. I interviewed politicians or thought leaders or members of civil society, and so much of it was around Brexit, for example, that I just thought it doesn't matter what I ask these people. It doesn't matter how clever or different or innovative my question is. We're just going over the same old stuff. And a lot of the people, the politicians particularly, will just, regardless of what question I ask, they will answer the question they want to answer. And I think that transaction had become really exhausting to me and unfulfilling. I thought what took me into journalism was probably my starting point in local news, where you're actually out a lot of the time talking to, in inverted commas, ordinary people and hearing people's stories and hearing about their real life experience. They weren't necessarily polished. They didn't have an agenda. They just told you how it was. And hopefully, if you did your job well as a journalist, they were able to be honest and authentic, and you could give voice to their story. And somehow my work had shifted so far away from that that I just used to turn up and think, oh, here we go again. So for me, I think the reflection took me to a point where I thought that's the essence of it. It's talking to people who want to engage with my questions, for whom my questions will be a source of real new thinking, and they will want to be curious about what their answers are. And in a roundabout way led me to coaching, where you're collaborating with someone. I ask a lot of questions, but I'm no longer the journalist. I'm just asking questions that facilitate other people's ability to think for themselves and to find answers for themselves and to do something that has a much more immediate impact than asking a politician about, you know, what are we going to do next year with the budgetary shortfall, and just hearing their normal garbage, if we're brutally honest.
Yeah, I actually think that's probably the reason why I left watching the news as well. It's not just the negativity that it brings, but the very little news that it actually brings. It's always an agenda. And if you're clever enough to notice that, you would realize you're not getting much out of it at all. The other day I was considering writing a quick book. So one of the ideas I have in mind now is to write quick books, books that would take me a month and a half to write. And there are 120 pages. And one of them was called Media Untraining. So the idea that whenever you become an executive or a politician or whatever, they train you on how to, like you rightly said, answer the question that you want, and how do you exaggerate statistics, and so on and so forth. And I thought it would be so useful for the public, for general readers, to actually learn about this and simply say, when he talks like this, he's not answering her question, right? I think that's a very interesting book. I probably, hopefully, will put the time in to do it at a point in time. Can I ask you about ego, if that's okay? I mean, I'm not shy to say, when I was at Google X, not just Google. So at Google, you're like really quite something, a very successful executive. And I was running half of the world. And then I go to Google X and I, you know, I was spending half of my time here and in Dubai and half of my time in Silicon Valley. And in Silicon Valley, I, you know, being chief business officer of Google X, it was another word for God, basically. Like, I would go to Blue Bottle Coffee on Sundays, and I would have at least 40, 50 people walking to me saying, Mr. Gaudat, I would love to have 15 minutes of your time to pitch my business. And it's, you know, it's quite ego gratifying to be in those places. And if I'm honest about it, one of the reasons why I was struggling to leave Google was, what am I going to be known for afterwards? How did you work through that, being such a familiar face on the BBC, delivering, being in people's homes every day, basically?
That is a really great question. And if I'm totally honest, I think I'm still working through it, actually. Because don't get me wrong, you've been very kind, Mo. I'm not a sort of household name here in the UK. I did do news presenting, but I'm not sort of one of the bastion of really well-known people. But, you know, people would sometimes go, oh, I've seen you on the telly, I know. And I had that cloak, as I refer to it in the book, of I work for the BBC, I'm a BBC journalist. And yeah, absolutely, there was some ego there. There was some safety there of being a kind of having a job that was known and respected. And I think having stepped into a different space and having to almost start from fresh and reestablish yourself and become a slightly different person who's known for something different, I think I'm still definitely working on that, actually. The book, you know, I'm really mindful. How interesting to play with this idea with you. Yeah, I'm really mindful that the book has given me some of that sort of credibility that perhaps I felt I was missing, because I was a relatively new coach. And it is odd, you know, if you've been a particular thing for a long time and you're known for that, it does make you feel a little bit naked to go back to basics and say, okay, I'm new at this new thing. I'm learning. I'm having to carve out a new identity and set up a new set of credentials and show that I can do this and I can help people. So yeah, you've got me thinking. I think ego is a big thing in career change, and it's something probably that's still deep inside my mind, still bangs about a little bit.
I ask the question honestly because when you talk about reflection, I have to admit, almost every change, not just career change, sadly, we define ourselves with what experiences or what titles or what we have, possessions. And it's frequent, for example, that somebody is in a relationship that is not working, but they would consider, what would I be without her, or what would I be without him? Or people who would be in jobs that are really, really very draining for them, but it's such a nice title on LinkedIn, and what would I do without that? And I think that's, I bring it up not to, to find the answer, but I bring it up because I think people will struggle with the ego side, big or small, you know, advanced in your career or not. There's always that kind of defining yourself by it bit that you, we need to overcome.
Yeah. And conversely, I don't want to take us off on too big a tangent, but it just got me thinking about the starting space of my career coaching was a lot to do with women who have stepped out of work to raise a family. And who are then returning, maybe as their children get a little bit bigger. And they almost have the opposite problem.
Correct.
In that they feel, and I, this is a big issue, but that years spent as a mother, as a mum often, I think certainly in the Western world, rob you of a lot of that identity and strip it back and give you a sense of, what have I been doing for the last 5 years? You know, as a mum, you've been working so hard. You've been learning so many new skills. You have stretched yourself to your very limits. But there's no title that goes with that. There's a kind of, oh, you're just a mum. You're just at home looking after the kids. So you've been robbed of all of that easy title, that easy, I can hang you on a hook and it means you're an impressive person because you were at Google or you were at the BBC. And for a lot of women, that is devastating for their confidence, because in our modern world, there's so little currency attached to, I want to say motherhood, probably parenthood generally, but it's an issue that affects far more women. So for them then trying to step back into work, they can feel very small and lacking in confidence because they've had all of that lovely label and safety stripped away. And they feel, what do I have to offer? Because people say, what have you been doing? And they say, oh, I've been on a career break for 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. And feel that that has no weight in the professional world. People are just like, oh, you mean you've got a big gap on your resume? And so that conversely is devastating to people. And it just, as we're talking about this, Mo, it's making me think we really need to, I don't mean you and I mean society as a whole, we need to be ready to play with this idea of what work status really is for people, and what the ways that we spend our time, whether that's in paid work or the unpaid work of caring for children or elderly parents or whatever it is, how we want to weight the relative importance of those things. So it's a big one, I know.
No, but I think it's pivotal, honestly, because define a career. What is a career? Is a career a series of jobs associated with a certain pay increase over the years? Is that what a career is? Or is a career a set of skills that you learn? Or is it a set of experiences that you gain? Or is it a set of contacts and people that you get to interact with? What is a career, right? I mean, if you measure a career by impact, then I will openly say, I think my wonderful ex's career raising Ali and Aya is much more impactful than my career building technology. I think she did so well at it. I always say, best mother I've ever seen. And the kids are incredible. And you have to admit, especially where we started, you know, where there was no internet, but also no books on parenting, no courses you can go to. The only source of information is your mom, which, you know, in many ways has destroyed you anyway. I mean, my mom didn't, but, and it's actually quite interesting, sort of from an impact point of view, what matters. And I have to admit, the definition of a career is actually missing. I'm going to ask you the question, but I think the question in my mind is someone that works for 3 years, then takes 2 years off to experience the world frequently, like 3 years, 2 years off, 3 years, 2 years off, does this count as a career, right? Is it a career choice? Is it something that we should consider?
I don't have a definitive answer, but I love the idea that counts, and that we can look more holistically. I mean, obviously the old school approach is, oh, that person's flaky, they can't stick at something, they keep moving on, they want. But I think what we're seeing, and my kids are 16 and 19, And I think that generation is looking at work in a much more holistic way as part of their life. I think historically we've kind of thought, I mean, the traditional work-life balance, you know, the idea that these things are binary. I think we're looking to almost try and find a way that we can live our lives where work, but also the other things, family and our own interests, can somehow intertwine more. And that may be naive. I know, obviously, if you're a big company, you don't want your half your workforce sodding off, you know, every few years to do something different. But can we start to see that they gain something from that they come back fresher and more creative and more inspired and with new ways of thinking and being and acting? I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? There's the sort of philosophical angle, which I'm really excited by. And then, of course, as often happens in life, we're like, what do we do with that practically?
Yeah, I think the idea is, if we're going to reflect, I think people are allowed to extend the meaning of the word career beyond just my job, beyond just my title, beyond just my pay. You know, I had a company that I worked for once that basically gave me a career planning guide. And the first few pages were about jobs and skills and what have you. And then they started to say, where in the world would you like to live? And where do you want to send your kids to university? And what languages would you like to learn? And I'm like, why are you asking me those questions? And it was actually quite interesting, because simply they were saying, look, you know, if we need a general manager in Brazil, and you said you want to learn Portuguese, and your kids are going to go to university in Mexico, maybe it's better to be in Rio or in Sao Paulo than it is to be in Dubai, right? And it's an interesting way of looking at it. And I think people need to include that in their view. Let's go to step three then, which I think is my favorite thing in the whole world. Imagining and designing. What is that?
So imagining and designing is all about generating ideas. And one of the first things I do with all of my career change or career clients, we don't have to call them career change, not all of them, I should say, end up making a big career change, because the reflecting shows them a few small tweaks will do it, actually. That's why it's so important to reflect periodically regardless, because sometimes it can be nuanced. You don't need to, you know, run off and join the circus. You just need to change some of the things you're doing. But yes, what I get all of my clients to do right from our first session, even before we get there, is to start collecting their ideas for careers. Wild, obvious, mad, you know, the ones that you'd need £1 million to do, the ones that are obviously connected to your job at the moment, and build a list and write them down. Because the problem we also have is, so many of our ideas we let just kind of float around in our heads, and they hit us every time we go on holiday and we finally have time on the sun lounger to think, what would be my dream job? But we never actually really engage with them. We just kind of let them sit there. So I say, let's collect these ideas and let's do something with them that allows us to properly explore them, even if they're bonkers. Because sometimes what seems like a bonkers idea is not as stupid as you think. And not because you can go and, you know, run a speedboat company on Lake Como and meet George Clooney every day. Maybe that's not going to happen. But putting that idea in the list allows you to actually be curious about it. I'm big with curiosity, Mo. It's, okay, what's behind that idea for you? You know, is it that you want to work outside? Is it that you love speedboats? Is it that you have a thing about beautiful, environmental, sustainable businesses? Is it that you actually, it's nothing to do with speedboats and lakes, it's all about George Clooney because you're crazy about film? You know, let's unpick it, because there are elements of that that may have something for you. It may be you can't run a speedboat, hire a company on Lake Como, but maybe you can run your own business in some way if it's actually more about, I want to do something of my own. I want ownership of something. Or is it, I just would love to have a spell working abroad, you know? So you can take these ideas and learn something from them and take bits that feel meaningful. And you can then work out for you what's realistic. And you can also generate more ideas if you need to, based on the real key principles that you start to see emerging from this ideas list. Because what can look initially like a really disparate list of ideas, often you can cluster them with either with the help of somebody else's eyes, or even just looking at it yourself, going, I start to see the themes here. there is a link, like there was for me, there is a link between being a journalist and being a coach. There are these threads that join these jobs that seem on the face of it that they've got nothing to do with each other, but actually the underlying skill set of questioning, listening, curiosity, analysis, communication, you can use those as a journalist, you can use those as a coach. And there are other jobs that exactly when you start to cluster in that way, you can say, aha, I'm seeing that the key skill set, the key drivers here are this. And where does that lead me to ideas that become then viable? And that's then the next step is thinking, okay, I've narrowed this down to some ideas, but I still don't really know what that job looks like. I still don't really know if it is possible. I still don't know what it would be called. I still don't know if I would like it. And then you have to start taking action.
Can I stop you before we talk about action and ask you, but when people imagine the tendency of the human brain is to be afraid, right? So they'll probably, a lot of the time, if you start imagining, people will start imagining, oh, but I will suck at it and I will have no money and then I will be stressed. So my husband will leave me and then I'll be homeless on the streets of New York. And right, you know how our brain can create drama. What would your advice be? I mean, is there a methodology that says imagine, but imagine only nice things? Or
what a good question. I think you're right. I think, first of all, even just knowing that your brain is not your friend is a good start. Yeah. And I spend some time on this in the book saying, you know, your brain is hardwired for certainty. The human brain is a prediction machine. Its job is to collect information and create shortcuts. And it wants everything to be predictable and obvious and clear. So when you start throwing things in that you don't really know anything about and that seem a bit wild and, you know, potentially unknown, the brain says, this is risky. Don't do this. We don't know anything about this. So I think almost knowing that as a starting point, that is just your brain's natural inclination. It may not really be based on reality. So let's lean into that and be curious. When my brain offers me a thought that if I do this, my husband will leave me, what real evidence do I have for that?
Exactly.
How else could I look at it? You know, yeah. And I know that's a flippant one, but you know, it will offer you lots more about like, no one will take you seriously. You will have to go and do a master's to change this job and it's going to cost you $7,000. You will have to go back to square one and take a £20,000 pay cut. You know, is that true? Let's find out. So I think knowing that your brain is likely to try and sabotage you for lovely, kind reasons. Thank you, brain. It's trying to keep you safe, but it's offering you odd thoughts. What else do you have to do? I think it actually leads back to that next step, which is all about taking action, because you cannot think your way into a career change. You cannot decide on what would be a possible next career for you sitting on the sofa, eating Pringles, Googling. And that's what so many people try and do. And oh, well, what a surprise. They never get anywhere. They just get hit by the klaxon of like, you can't do this. You can't do this. And they Google and they get no real information and they just sit there doing nothing. So the taking action is the really important step, actually, of career change, that you've got an idea, you've got lots of uncertainties about it, you've got lots of questions. Will this work? Will I like it? Is it possible? How much would I earn? Okay, here's the challenge. Go and find out. And I give lots of methods for this, but my favorite one, and I think in a way our meeting, Mo, is a lovely example of this. That for me, in so many areas of our life, and I think career change is no different, the magic is in other people, because other people are interactive and have real answers for you and can help you. And I don't mean help you like you go out saying, please give me a job. But one of the best ways to find out whether you're going to like being a dog groomer or whether you'd make a great graphic designer is to find a dog groomer, find a graphic designer and ask them for a cup of coffee. Don't ask them for a job. Don't send them your CV. Don't be overly annoying and demanding, but just say, I'm really interested in your journey. How did you get here? What's your job like? What do you do every day? So many of jobs, the problem we've got for career changes is, you know your own job. You know the handful of jobs around yours. You maybe know vaguely what your partner does, although often rarely. There's amazing statistics about you know, how little we understand about the jobs of other people in our lives. But so often we don't know what we don't know. We just think that could be interesting. So let's go and have some conversations with people and just ask them, what does your job involve, actually? You know, how do you measure whether it's fun? What would you be doing on an average day? What would you expect to have achieved by the end of this year? And all that kind of thing. And immersing yourself in these other worlds. So if you fancy being an HR director and yet you work in marketing and you know nothing about HR, well, find a way to go and spend some time in the HR department of your company, or ask your neighbours, who do you know who works in HR who'd have a cup of coffee with me, or who I could go and spend a couple of hours with and just nosy around what they're doing. So for me, that exploration phase gives you much more information, real information, not Google information. It gives you the ability to grow your confidence about, is this job right for me? Is it what I thought? Actually, I'm realizing that, you know, I went along, I did groom some smelly dogs for half an hour thinking it would be my dream job because I love dogs. But actually, I hate wet, smelly dogs. I don't want to go anywhere near them. You know, you've actually then got something to deal with. Uh-huh. And the important thing from that is, as you progress, as you get stuck into this exploration of these ideas, is people worry, well, what if it's not the right one? Well, you've found a low risk, quite quick way to test that. You haven't invested £5,000 to start a course to train as a psychotherapist before you've even ever spoken to a psychotherapist, ever visited a psychotherapist. You know, you're finding ways, and you can, if you get it wrong, there's no risk because you have just taken a few small exploratory steps. And great, you hated it. Brilliant. Tick that one off the list. Move on. That's great information. People worry like, oh, what if I don't like it? Well, if you don't, you know something you didn't know yesterday. Yeah, so correct. That's all good as part of the process. But the part that puts people off because they get worried they're doing it wrong, you're not. You've got to get stuck into the muddle in order to make progress.
There doesn't seem to be wrong in any of this. Like, you can't do it wrong, right? You're trying to do it right by actually knowing more, learning more. As I said in your introduction, this is a very introspective way of looking at a career. You're looking deep within you, and then you're going outside, and then you're finding out, and then you're saying, is that what I want to do? Do I like the smell of dogs when they're wet, right? I love that idea of it's actually so far, believe it or not, you have not once mentioned apply for a job. That's such an interesting approach to it. It's all about, who am I? Who am I? What do I like? What do I know? Is what I know enough? Can I know more? Such an interesting way of looking at it. And if you don't mind me saying, you're such a journalist. I mean, think about what you just did. It's like, I'm supposed to find my dream job, and then I'm going to go out and conduct an interview about it. That's so interesting. It's really the right way to do it. And I think it counts as a very valuable action. It's basically almost like going to university to learn about something, but you're doing it in a 2 hours wonderful coffee appointment with someone that basically gets you there.
Yeah. Or you go and try something. I mean, I have a story. It's a bad story against myself, really. But one of the ideas that I had years ago was, I thought I would love to do something artistic and creative. So I signed up, and this is another great way to test an idea, is to, you know, do it before you sign up for a 3-year course, you know, do a day's taster, do a weekend course, do an evening class for a term. And I got very interested in printmaking and lino cutting. And I just signed up for a really cheap weekly course at my local adult education college. And I really loved it. But I got to the point that I then started just in my head. I'd got a whole business in my head, Mo. I'd got like business cards. I'd got a website. I'd got it all. Yeah. But it was only in my head. And it was only when I then took another one of these just little exploratory steps, and I went along to a day's session about building a creative business. And I thought, great, I'll go and look at how I'm going to do this. I sat around a table with about 20 other people. And as I listened to their questions, and as we discussed and we went through the sessions, it became really apparent to me that those other people were already taking their cards or prints or whatever they were doing. They were going along to trade fairs. They were going along to craft days. They were selling stuff. They'd done so much. And I realized that all I was doing was in my head. And that was information for me, because I thought, if I really wanted to do this, I would be doing more. I would already be taking steps, but actually all I'm doing is daydreaming about what color my website should be and what font I want. Mm. And again, it's just all information, because you need to think, I'll try it and I'll see how it feels, perhaps. Again, that's the other thing I think about decision making, whether it's careers or anything else, is there's a lot of information in your brain, but doing everything cognitively is not necessarily the right approach. Your emotions and how you feel in your body have a lot of data for you as well. That hunt for the energy and the buzz, not because you can expect your job to have that 100% of the time, but thinking, when I go and do this thing, does it really bring me joy? Does it have a feeling of something important emotionally for me, whether that's in my heart or my gut and not just in my head? You know, and I appreciate, you know, we started talking about economic climate and things. So some of the work around career, yes, will happen in your head. What can I actually do? What's right for me at this time? But we also need to be alive to other signals from our body about what's right for us.
Are you not an advocate of jumping 2 feet in and saying, okay, I'm changing my job, I'm going to apply for 16,000 jobs and then 1,600 of them?
Yeah, the job application thing, it's the kind of spaghetti against the wall approach, isn't it? And I think it rarely works, but it is most people's first port of call. They sit in their office think, I hate this. It's Monday again, and I can't do another Monday. I know in my lunch hour, I'm going to apply for 27 jobs that potentially have something connected to what I do or that sound interesting, but which I'm not remotely qualified for because I've done none of the exploration work. I've done none of the sense of what would I need to show or demonstrate or have to make this change. So you just start throwing stuff out there. And of course, you become very quickly demoralized because that's not a great approach, because you're normally trying to shift into a new world that you don't know much about. Your application sucks. You're not positioning yourself as a strong candidate. You haven't spoken to a human being. So the applicant tracking system on the computer says no, in really big letters. No, you cannot have this job. You hear nothing, or you just get rejection letters. And of course, it's crushing to your confidence, and you soon get back to that thing where your brain says, aha, I told you we shouldn't do any changing. It's really not going to work for you. Confirmation bias, don't try and change your job because it's never going to work. But of course, you've gone about it a really silly way to just throw out applications and hope for magic. You've done none of the exploring. You haven't gone along to the conference or the book launch or the workshop that would help you kind of learn about that new world that you're thinking about, that would introduce you to people there, that would help you learn the language that you need in order to move into that world and apply successfully. So no, please, please do not take the every day I will apply to 15 jobs and gradually lose the will to live.
Exactly. That's not a very good career change, losing the will to live. I have to say, when you're talking about it, Rachel, in my mind, I'm sort of like wishing I wanted to change my career, because it's such a beautiful process to introspect so much and find out what you enjoy. And I have to say, I mean, even if our listeners don't want to change career, there is beauty in that tasting something before you jump both feet in. I mean, I'll say that, and I think it will sound weird for a lot of people, but one of my top advices for people going out dating is don't go to bed too early, please. Like, you know, like what you're saying, you know, just get to know a person a little more, spend a little more time waiting to get to that specific day of the month when you're going to be fighting. And so have a demo fight. Let's see how the demo fight will go. See if they really like Indian food, or have they been pretending for a couple of weeks because you're so attractive. And, you know, so those things really matter. It's all about, do I feel right here? Do I feel that this is me? And you seem, however, in the part five of the book, to sort of say, and don't be silly, this is not a 5-day process. Keep going.
Yeah. Right? So I call that last step, keep going, and how to last the course. Because although you said it's a fun process, and I think if you approach it as an explorer, it is. But it is also a process where you will discover things that are disappointing, potentially, or you yeah. will reach out to people who say, no, I don't have time, or things seem to fail. And I think knowing that that's normal in a career shift is important, first of all, actually, is to know that it will probably feel uncomfortable, but it has felt uncomfortable for every other person who's done it. So you're normal if you're finding this a bit wobbly. And to know that that liminal space, that period of being in between, where you haven't quite left one job and you're not quite sure what the next one looks like. You're in this kind of threshold space, liminal space, and that is unsettling. So being aware of those things, first of all, but then really recognizing that in order to keep going, you can lean into the fact that by trying new things, by expanding that comfort zone, you will grow as a person. And that's, I'm really mindful as a coach not to sound too sort of trite, because it doesn't happen overnight. But actually, again, if you try things, your confidence will generally grow. We often wait and think, well, I couldn't possibly go along to that meeting of graphic designers because I'm not a graphic designer, and I'll just wait till I feel a bit more confident. But actually, it's by going along to that kind of meetup and asking your questions and realizing, actually, everyone was really nice and I didn't come across as a total idiot. You suddenly feel like, oh, yeah, I feel a bit more confident now. And then they say, well, why don't you come to this session that's happening? And you think, oh, I do feel confident enough to do that. So those kind of tricks around building your confidence, getting out of your comfort zone, will help you keep going through the moments where you wobble, and also embracing that muddle, the muddle in the middle, I call it. People often, they start high energy with career change, like, yeah, I'm going to go and do something amazing and different. And then they hit a few setbacks and they can sort of feel like, oh, this isn't going to work. Or in that reflection space, that can be a moment where you have to get to grips with yourself. You have to be quite authentic about who you are. And I notice with my clients that what can happen first is you get more muddled before you get clear. And again, knowing that that's normal and being prepared to sit with the muddle for a while and just keep exploring, keep taking small steps, I think that's what helps people keep going. And then suddenly things start to fall into place. The picture becomes clearer. You get more confident about what you want and what's important to you. And then the steps up that ladder, or often off that tangent, off to that other new pathway, brighten and become clearer for you.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Can I ask you why you only focused on career change? When I looked at your work, I thought this would be so useful for someone who hasn't started a career at all. I think one of the biggest mistakes we humans make in a lifetime is you're a jazz player, but your dad tells you to study economics. And so you end up being an economist. And then 17 years later, you go like, I hate this. What would be different if we were to take this to our youngsters and tell them?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Funnily enough, I had someone on LinkedIn put underneath one of my messages, what advice would you have for young people? Do you do anything with young people? It's not a space I work in, but you're so right. I think a lot of it is applicable. And almost, again, it's a thing like, can we shake the whole system? I don't know. But certainly in the UK, the idea that you have to decide so early on, there's a narrowing that happens quite early on in the British system. So at 16, you take a set of exams where you're pretty much still doing everything from kind of maths and chemistry to French and English and history. Then 16 to 18, you're probably down to three subjects, maybe four. Then someone says, what are you going to study at university? Maybe one subject. And suddenly you think, how the hell have I ended up with a maths degree and everyone telling me I should be an accountant, when actually I just enjoyed, you know, being in the school play, or I loved coaching the football team. So I think it's, how do we keep our options open and make young people see all the sides of themselves and not get pigeonholed too early? We talked a lot about identity when we started this conversation and how work gives you an identity, but also the subjects you study quite quickly start to box you in people's imaginations. But actually, when you look at the statistics, most people do not end up in a field of work directly linked to the subject that they majored in or studied at university. Yes. And we need to keep that in the forefront of our young people's minds, I think. They can feel very weighed down by being asked to make a decision at 18 of like, oh my gosh, if I choose the wrong subject, that's it. I'm kind of laying out this path in front of myself now and I can never get off it. Whereas actually, unless you want to be perhaps a doctor or somewhere where you must have certain qualifications, things remain so open. And whether we can just do better at communicating that to our young people and modeling it for them. I think, funnily enough, the work hopefully that I'm doing with people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, saying to people, a career doesn't have to be a linear thing. We are allowed to go down some pathways, to go and explore some things, spend a few years there, course correct again. I think the more that happens, and it will, partly as a result of our own desires, but I think also because of the way the world of work is changing, hopefully that will filter down. And I think we'll probably, with my kids' generation, as I say, 19, 16, I imagine they will have a lot more twists and turns to their careers and a lot 100%. More different jobs and roles, which I hope is exciting because it means you can keep evolving and keep responding to your own changing needs, your own changing circumstances, whether those are philosophical or practical. So let's hope that, you know, what you decide at 17 doesn't straitjacket you into something that you are utterly miserable doing at 50.
Yeah. And if you're utterly miserable doing it by 27, I suggest you reflect, right? Prepare, then reflect, then imagine and design, then take action, and then keep going. I think the beauty of this model, as I said, Richard, in the introduction, is that you really are not talking about the technicalities of how to write a CV. That's such a waste of paper if you wrote that in a book. This is really almost like a monk being taught how to meditate and reflect and introspect and find insight, because insight is what creates a career that is worth living, really. Writing the best CV will probably get you more money, but that's not a career that's worth living, right? Maybe writing the worst CV. I remember one of the product managers that I hired at a point in one of my startup had applied to us at Google X with a search box. So basically, she sent a CV that had a type this in Google or something like that. And that was so clever, because when you typed it, you got an answer, and the answer was basically saying something about her. And it was really clever. She was not saying, I want to work at Google X. She was saying, I want to do something very creative. Okay, and that's very, very different. It's not an approach to find a job. It's an approach to find a life that you think is worth living. Can I ask you, so the most common way people look at careers is, I have a career to make money or to get recognition and fame, right? And then, of course, because of the brainwashing that happened after the Industrial Revolution turned into an information revolution, and to get people committed, we started to convince people that work is your life's purpose. It's the only reason why you're here on earth. And so people now work for purpose and impact, right? Any other reasons why people should choose a career?
I always want to invite people to just tap into what is important for them. I think the whole debate around passion-led careers, which seems very kind of in vogue at the moment, you find your passion and then you turn it into a career. Again, for some people, that's fantastic. They want to work because they want to be every day kind of living out this passion. They want to monetize it. But again, I think that can be quite an intimidating thought for a lot of people who are like, yeah. Ooh, I don't have a passion. What would a passion look like? I'm knackered. I've got two kids. I'm hardly getting any sleep. I've got no time left for hobbies or passion or anything. I just need to get to work. Please, God, finish at 5 o'clock so I can get to pick up my kids from childcare. So I feel like we want to just give people permission to lean into what they need from their work at a particular time. And it is different for everybody. And I think the more we try and say it has to be, you know, some people maybe do want to make millions of pounds. Is that bad? I don't know. If we tried to straitjacket them into doing something with purpose, would they just rebel against that? And similarly, you know, if we say to people, you must follow your passion, does that just make some people utterly miserable? Because actually their passion is surfing, but they don't want to run a business. They don't want to teach, they're rubbish at teach. They don't want to teach people to surf. They just want to have a job in the week that is reasonably predictable so that every weekend they can get on their board and go surfing and have fun. So, yeah, I think it's back to curiosity. It's back to that sense of, what do I want from work? And whether we try and suggest work has to have a purpose or a passion versus making lots of money and having status, I don't know. What does it mean to you is the question I always, that's what I'm essentially working with my clients on. What is work for? What will give you the most enjoyment and fulfillment from your work? I had a conversation the other day with a mum. She was not a client, she's just a friend. She was looking for work. She was a super smart woman. She'd had a professional career, but she was busy with her family. She had a daughter who was having some mental health issues. She wanted work that would get her out of the house, would be involved with a team, would allow her to have a different focus, some mental stimulation, just something. And for her, I'm not saying she couldn't do more. I'm sure she'll go on to. But for her at this moment, that is what she needed from her work. And that was what would give her joy and give her stimulation and give her the ticks in the boxes that she'd identified. So, you know, people listening, you, me, what are your boxes? Don't let anybody else tell you what your boxes are.
I love when truth is told on slow-mo. This is wisdom. This is career wisdom. I love the way you said this. I'll close with my typical question. I always try to go back to happiness. Can a career bring us happiness? What would be the secret to that?
I think it can absolutely make a big part of your happiness, yes, because it is something that you're going to probably do, as pension ages, retirement ages creep up. You could be doing this for 50 or 60 years, but hopefully this gets to change as you go. So I think it can bring you happiness if you allow it to evolve with you and you keep checking in with what happiness looks like. But also I think that total shift that we're in danger of making from the kind of pre-industrial revolution, you know, you just go out to the fields, you do your job, it's bloody boring, but you get your money at the end. You know, that kind of, you just work to live. That shift we've slightly made to kind of, we need to live to work. Work must be everything. It must give us everything. To me is as bonkers as the idea that your life partner has to be everything to you. And you have to expect that they will bring you everything you need. I think it's always about looking at your work and your career within the context of your wider life. And one of the things I notice with clients is that when we spend some time about interests, that reflective moment, and I say, let's do a session on what you're interested in. Sometimes it's not about deciding that because you love art, you should go and take an illustration course and start illustrating books. It's not, that doesn't have to be the answer. Sometimes people just go, I don't want to do that for work, but talking about this has reminded me that I used to love drawing. Or someone will say, my interest is music. And oh my gosh, I used to be in a choir when I was 18 and I let that go once I had kids and got busy. But do you know what I'm going to do? I'm not going to try and retrain as an opera singer, but I am going on a Friday night to join my local choir and that will bring me joy. And I don't need to turn it into work, but it has allowed me to see that in other parts of my life, there are changes that I want to make and career is one part of them, but we have agency in other parts of our lives as well. Yeah. And it's for us to play around with that balance.
Yeah, it's that augmented experience, you know, a job that allows me to have that time on Friday night so that I can go and do this because it's part of what makes me who I am and it's part of the journey of my life. And I think that's a beautiful definition of what a career should be. That one message that you sent out on LinkedIn, I think that led me to a place of a lot of joy and enlightenment today. I'm grateful that you wrote this. I really am. I'm grateful that you looked at this as a journalist, honestly, that there is that curiosity of why, what should I be, where should I go? Not just, okay, time for a promo, time for another job. Wonderful work, Rachel. I'm so grateful that you were my guest today. And thanks for all that you shared. It's really wonderful.
Been a really interesting conversation. I love it when I come out of these conversations thinking, Mo's given me something to think about. So it's been great talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And for all of you listening, I really think this was an eye-opening view for us because really, even if you are not thinking of changing your job and if you love what you're doing, as Rachel said early on, that reflection on the frequent check-in on where am I in life? How much did I change? What do I want to be? Where do I want to be? What brings me joy? I think it's something we need to do not only about our careers, but perhaps about where we live and who we live with and what we're doing with our time and hours and everything, really. I think it is a valuable view to have that curiosity about who you really are, not just what's out there. When next time you're searching for a job, try to start from what you are, not what's on offer, and what you want, not what they can give you. And I think when you look at it this way, I think your career choices will probably become a path to your happiness and to your fulfillment. I definitely recommend Rachel's book, The Guide to Career Change, and I definitely recommend that you hear more of her work. I will leave her contacts in the show notes if you want to get in touch. And yeah, maybe as you do what I ask you to do every week and take a little bit of time to slow down, take a bit of time to slow down and think about your career and your life and reflect and see where you want to go. And while you're doing that, maybe because you are kind to me, you would want to share this, like it, send it to others, tell others about it, because that would make more people aware of what I'm trying to do here to spread those messages that would make everyone's life better. I would be very grateful for that. I thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to meet so many interesting people. And I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.